Student Achievement and School Accountability Session. And we welcome the members who are here on time, and we appreciate that. And we also want to extend a welcome to those who are going to testify and to those who are interested in the subject. So with that, I think we have some invited testimony. We'd like to hear from Dr. Joe Cox, if we may, the Chancellor of Higher Education.
Chair Baxter, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. Matt Paul asked if I needed a mic. I said no, I was the last of the loud history professors, so I probably...
All right.
For the record, I'm Joe Cox, Chancellor of the University System. And for the new members, I've been in that role since 1994, and before that I was president of the university in Ashland for 7 years.
Of what? Excuse me.
Of the university in Ashland, Southern Oregon University. Mm-hmm. In those days, it was Southern Oregon State College. Mm-hmm. That's how long it's been.
Sucks.
Yep.
What I thought I would do in the time you've given me is to try to give you a brief overview of the university system, where it is, some of the complexities of it, some of the challenges we face, and I'll do that as expeditiously as I can to allow lots of time for questions, and I'm sure, Chair Bank, that you'll let me know when we're nearing the end of the time that you have. So, 7 campuses, with the Oregon Health Sciences University still in an affiliated relationship with us. Those 7 campuses are scattered across the state, and we're going to show you some graphics in just a minute. We are in every county in the state. If you think about it, 143 sites, 143 different cities, 7 campuses ranging from Klamath Falls to Ashland to LeGrand to the Valley campuses. University centers in Bend and over on the coast. The university center is an upper division location on a community college campus where we broker in programs from public and private institutions to try to maximize opportunity. The red dots are extension centers and county extension offices scattered across the state. You think of us as being roughly 60,000 students. That's the 60,000 traditional students that we would typically think of on our 7 campuses. In fact, we touch 250,000 Oregonians or more, probably 250,000 to 300,000 Oregonians a year. 60,000 students in regular campus situations, another 30,000 students in the summer on those campuses, another 90,000 students in evening, weekend, courses off the satellite, courses off the web. You may not know it, but we have 5,000 students this year taking courses that are bounced off satellites all across Oregon. At the same time, 7 nurses are sitting in Lakeview in a television situation. Students are sitting in Ashland over on the coast, and the broadcast is coming from OHSU in Portland. So what we're saying is our motto is education by all means. That's both a declarative statement and an operative one. So, Grant, if we could move to the next. This is probably of interest to you. You have the hard copies. Yours are probably more readable. This is where our Oregon students come from. And you can see every county in the state. You can see the heavy grouping in the Willamette Valley, which won't surprise anyone. But rather large numbers, given the population, across eastern Oregon. I would point out that, and I do this with my close friends, you could lay the state of Pennsylvania in the eastern third of Oregon and still have 2/3 of Oregon left to go. That's the enormity of the state that we try to serve. And that small college in LeGrand has a huge service area, ranging from from Mount Hurd County to the south to Wallowa County to the north. And they are all over the place in all kinds of delivery modes, and that's how we do it. Right, let's go to the next one, because I want to get to some of the... This is the output. This is the last graduating class, 15,000 degrees conferred. When you add the 610 conferred by OHSU, it exceeds almost 16,000 degrees annually. Think of it this way. Just about 72 or 73% of the students in Oregon who attend a 4-year institution are at one of our schools. We award about 73% of the degrees in 4-year programs awarded in Oregon. So this is it's a large enterprise, it's a complex enterprise, and beyond the instructional component that is so crucial for us, we're a roughly $220 million research enterprise annually. Money we bring into the state, research grants from private, public entities across the world. If we didn't exist as a research industry, you would have the economic department create us. Because it's good,
all right.
It's a good, clean enterprise. We don't pollute very much, I don't think. Our product is clean, it's usable, and it's paid for by somebody else. That research enterprise probably employs 5,000 to 7,000 Oregonians beyond the immediate faculty who are the key to make it work. The public service enterprise is probably best represented, that's the third part of our function, probably best represented, if you think about it, by things like the Extension Service at Oregon State University, or things like the outreach effort out of Portland State University's College of Education, working with second graders who aren't reading at grade level at a school in Portland. Or perhaps it's a silviculturist out of Oregon State who's trying to help a tree farmer in eastern Oregon figure out why that particular stand of trees is diseased. That's the public service component. The budget, for every dollar you give us, we generate two or three more, either through tuition or through gifts, grants, contracts, and matching dollars. It's a large enterprise. It's $1.4 billion, roughly about a third of which is general fund. In some institutions it's less, some it's more. We are very much a business in many respects. We operate a whole series of hotels, restaurants. They're called dining halls, or at least they used to be. They're no longer called dining halls anymore. They're called food courts. So if you ask where the dining hall is on a campus, you probably won't be told anything. You won't be given directions. But if you ask where the food courts are, they can point you. We operate a whole series of auxiliary enterprises that are not funded at all by state dollars. They're funded by student fees and bonds that we sell to build this campus, to build those campus facilities. So it's very much a business, but the business that we're about is clearly education. Athletics, since we did well this year, I'll mention it.
All right.
There have been years when we skipped right over this dimension of my presentation.
Yes.
But with President Frohnmayer in the room, I will mention how proud we were that a number of our institutions did extraordinarily well. I have a duck son and a beaver daughter. And I managed to make the mistake one year of going to the Civil War game with the two of them.
Oh.
And I lasted until halftime. But that's important. There's no question. If you think about the publicity that the state of Oregon got from those major bowl games nationally, no question, it has been off and benefit. Ben, let's move on. So I work for a board of citizens that the governor appoints and you confirm. It's a citizen board. They range from CEOs of major Oregon businesses to small business owners. There are students on our board. There are two students who are chosen by their colleagues, and they are duly voting members of the board. And most recently, in a departure from past practice, with the governor's approval, we've added a faculty member as a voting board member. And this group of citizens, they serve four-year terms, so they can be appointed for a second term. And they take seriously this enterprise that you've given them responsibility for. And they've boiled it down to four overarching goals that they try to hold in front of them as they plan and as they hold us accountable for implementing those plans. Access, particularly access to Oregonians who have not had access. That's why the university centers are in Bend and over on the coast. Those are place-bound students who can't just pick up and come to the Valley to finish a degree. If you want to be inspired, I urge you to go spend an afternoon in the little university center at SWOC in Coos Bay and just sit and talk to the students who are in that program. You'll come away feeling this is pretty good stuff. This is really pretty important. But access, particularly to populations which have not participated, we are particularly focused on trying to get more students of color and more students who are from underrepresented groups into our campuses, and I think we're making some progress there. Quality. If it isn't access to quality, then it isn't worth very much. And how do you measure quality? We're going to show you a bit later this session some of the qualitative indicators that we use to try to judge how good a job we're doing. and some of them will surprise you. How are our students national examinations after they complete? That's a pretty good benchmark. I will just use one example. Engineering, where you sit for a national exam and a state exam. Our students score in the high 90th percentiles. The national average for passing on those exams is in the middle 70s, middle to high 70s. Look at the nursing exams. Look at the graduation rates and the pass rates on the accounting exams. Those kind of output measurements, chair back one, that wouldn't surprise you at all. We are increasingly trying to find out both what our students think of the education they have received and what the employers who hired them think of those students. The first is easier to do, and we have some awfully good data, and I'm pleased to tell you that our graduates tell us that we get very high marks for, yes, they would repeat again, and yes, they would go to the same school in the high 80s and low 90s. Employability, that's a new one for us, because that is something that has been part of the college's responsibility over the years, but we're taking it more seriously. Are we preparing our graduates for the real world? How do we know that? One of the goals that this board has set for us is to have an internship opportunity or a practicum opportunity for as many students as possible, the goal being 100%. About 4 years ago, we had about 56% of our students who were managing to complete an internship. We've driven that number up into the 60s and the low 70s, and the goal is to get it much higher. The connection between employability and whether they've had an internship is extremely high. The best example I can give you is the program in engineering that Oregon State created years ago called MECOP. It's probably the finest engineering cooperative internship program I've ever seen. And if you look at the correlation between those students and where they did their internship and where they're hired, it's a no-risk situation for both. Cost-effectiveness, increasingly important to us, trying to be certain that we've been able to say to both our students who pay the tuition and their families and the state, which provides general fund support, that we've done a good job with the money you gave us. Two bills that this will be in your packet, but your predecessors on two different occasions challenged us to become more efficient and to become more entrepreneurial, and they assured us that we would keep the resources that we saved. The first was Senate Bill 271, which took us out from under the state structure in personnel, contracting, and purchasing. We said we would save enough money with that step to educate the next 1,000 Oregon youngsters without additional state support. We educated 2,000 additional Oregon residents without additional state support. We saved $6.5 million, pumped it back into greater access. Senate Bill 919, from the 97 session, actually we worked with our legislative colleagues to create a report card format to give you a recording of how well we thought we had done against the targets we had set for individual campuses. And each campus sets its own targets and goals, and we'll be back to talk with you at some length about that. For example, you have to take into account the fact that the University of Oregon is a considerably more residential institution than is Portland State. So you're going to have a different student pattern of attendance, and that has to be factored in. We are accountable. We report to you, and we'll show you, if you put the next one up, Grattan, these measurements that campuses are asked to report on. Under quality, they provide to us data on successful completion and the graduation rate and the abilities of the students who are graduating. We try to evaluate the quality of faculty we are attracting and are able to retain. We look at customer satisfaction through surveys of our graduates. Access, the campuses are challenged to increase their participation rate by previously underrepresented populations. They're challenged to carry their products to markets which have not been well served. Employability, we try to match carefully the work of the Progress Board. We work with the AEA, the Electronics Association, and other organizations to try to be sure that we're doing everything we can to meet the state's workforce needs. Cost effectiveness, we look very closely at how entrepreneurial the campuses are in terms of their behavior and how well they're managed, and that's the bottom line at the end of the year. Now, the challenge I want to show you is represented in the next several slides. This is simply what's in the pipeline coming at us, and we track it back to 1980, and those are the actuals. we face in Oregon an increasing number of graduates of our public and private high schools out through at least 2010 through 2011 in fairly significant numbers. In 94-95, the output from the high schools with reasonable college intentions was 29,228. It jumps to 38,000. That's the challenge facing us. Our enrollment this fall is the highest in the history of the system.
Mm.
Measure 5, and some of you will remember the results of that, Measure 5 blew 6,000, 5 or 6,000 students out of the system overnight when we raised tuition 38% in one fell jump. We struggled through the 90s, and the students are back. They're back big time. The previous legislature challenged us to keep more of the best and brightest home. We have turned those numbers. Our percentage of the Oregon senior classes in high school who are going on to university is increasing. We're back up at historic averages, and we set new records this fall for our freshman classes. The next slide is simply another way of looking at the same numbers. That is one of the challenges. How will we meet that? How will we meet that demand? One of the key things affecting our world is that the graduation rate out of high school is going to increase by about 5% between now and 2003, from 31.6 to about 33.2, and it will go up. It'll peak in about 2008-2010. Our freshman participation rate, Oregon residents only, is up on all of our campuses. The Oregon resident students are back. There was a time when they went out of state in great numbers because of fears of instability. The system was in turmoil. We took out 100 programs, and that suggested instability, and we sent all kinds of wrong messages, in my view, the hindsight. We've managed to turn that around, and the Oregon students are back in significant new numbers, and we've got to find a way to meet that. Most recently, what the board has done is to change completely in the last legislative session the way we allocate our resources, the way we request, and the way we reallocate our resources. I won't trouble you by plowing through the old budget model. It was a 1970s version. We're not going to do it. I couldn't explain it to you if I had 2 weeks. There were 250 working parts. The new model is so simple and so transparent and so incenting of entrepreneurial behavior that it's worth a few minutes to talk about. First and most importantly, all tuition now stays on the campus where it's generated. All tuition, all fees, all income derived from students. The income in terms of residence halls and all of that operation had always remained on the campus. But we used to take the tuition and pool it, and then it was distributed in a model that, well, it was distributed differently. That's all I can say about it. It did not reward performance. Now, if an institution increases its share of students, if an institution meets new markets, meets new challenges, finds a new venue that wasn't being served, it is immediately rewarded by keeping all of the tuition it generates, and that reward is immediate. It's not rear-view mirror budgeting for where you were 2 years ago. And what that's done, I think, is it's translated very quickly into campus behavior to be as successful in marketing, nothing wrong with that word, is to be as successful as they can be in marketing, and particularly in meeting new populations of students who have not been previously served. Going after the students who were going out of state in the downturn of the 90s, we've done that very successfully. We refinanced ourselves with out-of-state students for about 5-6 years, using the U of O and Southern Oregon as two examples of how that was done. The out-of-state market is drying up because California has turned its situation around, and in fact, they're investing heavily in their universities, as is Washington to the north. The Oregon resource allocation model, leave it up just for a minute, Grattan, does two things I think it's important for you to achieve. One is it rewards building access in places where it didn't exist. It rewards qualitative improvements in programs because we have a performance evaluation component of this that pays off for campuses on making progress against benchmarks. let's go on to the next one, because I think this will probably say it most clearly. This is the model in its most simple form. Three components. Left-hand column, all tuition and fees, student-centered, stays where the students are, and the dollars follow the students. The second column refers to the state tax funds, the general fund, that is the component of the budget that the legislature defines. Just about equal to tuition now in the current budget situation. It's just about equal to tuition. The state support also follows the enrollment. When the budget is distributed to the campuses, it goes where the students are. If there's been a movement into engineering, the dollars follow. If there's been a movement to one campus rather than another, the dollars follow. And the dollars are distributed with an eye to looking at actual costs of programs. We've spent some time determining what our peer universities across the country, public universities, are spending in engineering on average, what those costs are, what are spending in English, are spending in sociology, are spending in philosophy. And obviously there are significant cost differences between disciplines. And if an institution experiences, well, I'll just give you a case in point. If you have a significant increase in the enrollment in engineering at Portland State University, and there's no budget response to that, recognizing the higher cost of the engineering programs, Portland State will have no choice but to either limit the enrollment or affect the quality. So this model tracks the actual cost of programs, attempts to have the dollars deliberately follow that, and holds the institution accountable for how they're spent. For the first time in the university system's 70-year history, there is an allocation model that is student-centered, absolutely student-centered. It is understandable, and we have to be accountable, because it's transparently clear to you as you look through our budget where the dollars are coming from and where they're going. Stakeholders know what they're buying. We have an engineering industry council which advises us on how to invest our engineering resources. That council understands exactly what the cost of engineering is at Oregon State, at the upper division, at the lower division, at the graduate level. The model takes into account what costs really are, and the state then has to evaluate how much of that cost it is prepared to sustain, to support through the general fund. Over on the third side, you have specific targeted investments, and those are going to change from session to session. Targeted investments in areas that are not enrollment driven, but that meet state needs. For example, statewide public services, substantially at Oregon State University, some $90 million in support for the Extension Service, Cooperative Education, the Forest Research Lab. There are state initiatives, the engineering investments that the legislature has made over the last several years, the creation of the Engineering Fund and Senate Bill 504, that's a targeted investment. Then there are specific elements of investment that reward performance, that deal with the small schools and their in surviving in a system which is really based on an average, effective average of about 7,000 students, support for research, and various board initiatives. For example, if the board decided it wanted to improve circumstances in reading instruction in the teacher education program, it could make a targeted investment for a period of time in that, see its results, and decide whether to continue it or not. So you have three elements. Tuition-based revenue, campus-based revenue, the state support funded, allocated through the model in the middle column, and then in the third column, investments that legislators decide to make in specific targeted areas. Let me go on now, because I want to get quickly through these and see what kind of questions you have. I was asked to put onto a transparency our current, where we came out of the last session and the current recommendation. We came out of the last session, this is general fund. This is the general fund, the tax dollars. 1999-2001, legislative approved budget, $754.7 million. We had requested an 804 current services level, as state agencies do, to continue operations at their present levels, adjusted for inflation, whatever. That would have been 804. The current services level in the recommended budget is at 708.7, to which are added $53.5 million in policy packages, which you see at the lower right. policy packages very quickly are $20 million in engineering, $17 million in enrollment to fund additional enrollment growth, $8 million in an adjustment to balance up the small universities. We thought we had them right. We didn't. And so there's an $8 million adjustment for the four small institutions to take account of the fact that they have higher operating costs given their size, and the model works best if you're at about 7,000. So we tried it. We thought we had it right in the first budget. We didn't. And Grattan, what am I missing? $7.2 million to establish a branch campus, in, to begin a branch campus in Bend. Those are the policy options. We used to call them decision packages that the board had put forward and which the governor has supported in his budget for a total of $762.2 million in general fund. Included in this, in the governor's recommended, excuse me, recommended budget, is a tuition increase. And just, I want to make clear that for 4 years there was no tuition increase. Our tuition had become so high, given our 10 western states that we compete with, that the governor and the legislature had for two biennia bought down any tuition increase. And by putting additional general fund money in, we had avoided a tuition increase for 4 years. What that did, members of the committee, it brought our tuition down in the 10 western states from very near the top in public universities to about the middle or slightly below the middle, which is where we were hoping to get. In this budget, there is a proposed tuition increase, Grattan, which is 4%.
4%
and 4%. 4% year one, 4% year two. That is the first tuition increase in 4 years, and that's included in the governor's recommendation. The next slide basically displays the exact same thing in somewhat different form. And I was asked to include on the last two transparencies, these are in your packet, what the original OUS requests had been versus the governor's recommendations. And the $53.5 million is displayed in the right-hand column, and the original requests are displayed in the left-hand side. Would close with this. The challenges that we're presented with by the budget, by this budget, have to do with balancing the issue of access, back to the board's goal, access for how many, in what places, cost, at what price, what is the price the student should pay, what share of the total cost. Another way of asking that is, what is the state share of the cost of instruction? That's the state general fund support. The other element, of course, has to be quality, because at what quality are you providing those services? And so this is the balancing act that we're engaged in at the moment. And I'm not going to mislead you. We're presented with some real challenges, and we're wrestling with them. And as the session goes along, we'll probably be back if you ask us. We'll ask to come back and talk a bit about how we are wrestling with some of those challenges. A lot's been said in the newspaper about mega tuition increases, and I would just like to comment to you about that. In the hydraulics of the budget model that we've created, if the state's support diminishes, we have two choices. We could either backfill that with additional tuition or somehow reduce the allocation of the allotment of programs or somehow affect the quality or access or the volume. Those are about the choices you have. I was asked, would this result in double-digit tuition increases? And I said, I hope not. I hope it does not. That got translated in some reports into the chancellor is in favor of double-digit tuition increases. I'm here to tell you I'm not. I mean, I'm the product of a public university. I know what I owe. I owe everything. The university gave me a chance. I mean, I'm absolutely seriously. I know what I owe. And the opportunity to participate, this is the ladder to the middle class. I'm an example. And so I'm not an advocate of double-digit tuition increases. I will say to you, though, that there, and this is a continuing conversation with the governor's office, there may be a need to move beyond the 4%. I hope not. I hope not very much, but there may be that need. I mean, I don't want to be disingenuous and not say that. But double digit each year, no. Or Bill Wyatt said to me one day that his son had come off from school in Portland and said, well, Dad, my high school counselor said that the OUS tuition is going up to 50%. No. I wouldn't be here. I'd be looking for the other half of my bus ticket. So let me just stop and ask if there's any question that I can drill down on or come back with more information about.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you. Chancellor Cox, as much as I enjoy your presentation, I would rather hear it from a blue ribbon panel that came before the legislature as a quality education group did, and to make recommendations based on an in-depth interim study working with your group. And I think that would carry ultimately more weight. I would also like to see the same kind of charge or requirement that was passed by the voters that required the legislature to fund the programs that are at the recommendation of this panel or tell the reason why. So I wish you would help me work toward that, because I'd like
I'd be happy to do that. There are the results of several blue ribbon panels are background to this that we'd be happy to.
Yeah, well, I guess what I'm saying is I think it would be more effective if that blue ribbon panel came to us with you as the backup to urge that we follow the recommendation that was very carefully put together with your figures and with their expertise. And I'm talking about maybe the Oregon Business Council, and Duncan Wise was here the other day and I raised this issue with him. And so I think that we have to, in a sense, follow the lead that was established by chance and with K-12, where there is a quality education model that was carefully worked out over two interims, actually, and then the measure that was passed by the voters and recommendation to the governor saying they have to listen to these experts. And I think that would really add weight to what you're recommending, and I do applaud you for what you've presented, but I think that we need to work toward.
Well, what I would be happy to share with the committee, I don't have it with me, but in terms of the development of this new budget model of ours, we use consultants, and this was a blue ribbon effort across the country using national figures as advisors. And when we say that the model is funded at, our goal was to be funded, general fund, at something like the median, the average of our peers. We were nowhere near their average. We got up with the infusion of dollars last session to about 88% of the average. And that's we have that documented in terms of actual costs from sister universities and the advice of experts. But I can produce that for you. But I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, may I ask a...
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess the follow-up would be that there's a portion that you didn't talk about, and that's the salary disparity between the university system and higher ed system in Oregon and other states. California.
Major challenge.
Major challenge. And I think that when you talk about that, it becomes a kind of a self-serving thing. And so I think that has to be part of the recommendation. So I'm looking at an overhaul in a sense of the higher ed funding system that is established by a system that works.
I would be pleased to work
from interim to interim, and so we establish a new way of arriving at what the needs are based on some of the accountability things that you've talked about. And I think it's great that you have, you know, identified those goals, how to measure those goals, and I think those are the kinds of things that would really get the attention of the legislature. And I think we owe it to the citizens of our state to adequately fund education. We have to explain why we need it.
Case in point, this week our board member, faculty board member Jerry Richmond, is professor of chemistry at University of Oregon and distinguished woman scientist, national, international reputation. And she was really distressed yesterday. They're trying to interview 10 possible new faculty in chemistry. They won't hire 10, but they're looking at 10 candidates, and the candidates are just calling to withdraw their interest because they're being attracted by Washington or California, which is putting $300 million into three new research enterprises. And that's top faculty at that level have those kind of choices. And our faculty compensation schedule, Representative Morissette, is a challenge. And I'd be happy to work with you.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Chancellor, regarding your tuition increase of 4%, have you done any studies to determine if that will keep students out of college?
We have 30 years, Representative Smith, 30 years of data that indicates that for reasons that I'm not sure we fully understand, that tuition increases in Oregon are much more sensitive and there's much less elasticity than anywhere else I've ever been. And I'm not sure that I can tell you why. I had a student explain it to me one night in a gas station, Grants Pass. I'm not sure that's scientific, but I'm not close to it.
Yeah, very real.
We're at about the 53rd, 54th percentile nationally in terms of our public university tuitions.
Mm-hmm.
But in the West, once you cross the Mississippi, mm-hmm. there's been this tradition for 100-some years of as low tuition as possible in the public universities. Mm-hmm. On the East Coast, where I'm originally from, mm-hmm. University of Maryland, University of Delaware, tuitions are regularly $5,000-$7,000 for in-state students. Ours are $3,500. But there's been this Western tradition of access through virtually free tuition. Now, we've moved a long way from free tuition. It doubled in the last decade. And the issue in Oregon is we may be at the 53rd, 54th percentile in terms of our tuition nationally, but Oregon incomes for many, many people, and if you look at median incomes, are not at those same 54th percentile nationally. I was over on the coast meeting with one of the mayors, and tuition came up, and we were talking about it, and she said, well, here's the problem. The median family income in my community is about $22,000. And that's the gap, I think, Representative Smith.
So you're saying, yes, it will affect new enrollees.
You have, the fact that we have not increased it for 4 years will have some leavening effect of the impact. But we know that every time we raise tuition more than several hundred dollars at a time, it does have an impact. And it does cost us some enrollment. And when we raise tuition and it costs us enrollment, it hits us three times.
Yeah, I know it does.
Because we lose not just the tuition, mm-hmm. we lose the general fund, which you didn't provide because the enrollment isn't there. And our cost for our bonded indebtedness on all the facilities continues to be based on the numbers that we thought we were going to have. Mm-hmm. So it's a three-way.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I have a second question regarding the governor's recommended CSL. If you were to operate under that figure, what major cutbacks would you have to implement throughout your university system?
Well, funny you should ask that. We met yesterday for about 6 hours, the President and I in the morning and the Board Finance Committee and the President in the afternoon. I don't have concrete answers for you at this point.
Are you saying but there would be major?
Well, if the scale back of that magnitude, there it has to show somewhere, and you can do so much through administrative reductions and efficiencies.
But on the same time, you know, we have this disparity in the incomes we pay our teachers. You know, so my other
a young man at Southern told me last year that he was leaving because he wasn't going to be able to afford to send his kids to Southern. That was devastating.
Another question, Mr. Chair. What about federal money?
Well, we are particularly dependent in the research area on federal dollars. I don't have it in my head, but it's a major part of the research dollars that we generate from National Science Foundation, Department of Agriculture, et cetera, NIH. But those dollars are for specific purposes to conduct the research. The most of our federal dollars that would be fungible dollars are in financial aid.
Mr. Chair, regarding our new president-elect's emphasis on education, and I know this is a crapshoot for you, do you see any more of the federal dollars coming into our university system from what he's proposing?
Well, based on two interviews that I've read with mm-hmm. Secretary of Education,
I don't anticipate a great deal in the form of additional federal dollars. I wish I could tell you I did.
Well, that's what I want to know.
I don't.
Okay.
That's the case.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Cox, I applaud your resource allocation model, not having served on this committee in the past, but coming from a business perspective. I'm very interested in the way you have provided, at least as you've described it, real-time feedback for the initiatives that your different universities undertake. I'm curious, though, about two aspects of that. One is the mechanics, and I don't need a detailed explanation here, but the mechanics of how you deal with an unpredictable shift in enrollment and being able to plan. Your faculty member, I presume, are whole people, and so you need a whole chemistry professor. You can't just have... So there's that aspect of how you do the actual real-time. And I'm also very interested in what kind of competitive atmosphere this creates among your universities, and how do you balance the need for cooperation among the different campuses with, frankly, they have to be competing for those bodies because you've set up a system that they get rewarded for more bodies.
Two-part question. I'll try to do a two-part answer.
Okay.
When we moved to this new budget model, two things were very, very clear. The system would have to maintain a reserve.
Okay.
Off the top to begin with, an enrollment reserve to deal with the settling up,
mm-hmm.
if there's been a sudden shift to Southern from Western or whatever. So it's dealt with at the system level with a settling up process at the end of each year of the biennium, where there are folks who contribute back and those who receive additional money out of that reserve. Each campus is enjoined by board policy to maintain its own reserve for enrollment and other contingencies, and they have done that, even the smallest ones. The second question is, I have a referee shirt, and I have a hockey puck on my desk, and I don't have a whistle, but I have a big goalie stick, and I guess I'm the enforcer. The board and I play the balancing act. But the competition has always been there. But there are some things we've learned about it, that we compete significantly, and I have to show you the data to convince you. Our campuses compete in different student markets. We've discovered that there's very little crossover, for example, between the students who are applicants at Western Oregon in Monmouth and the students who are applicants at Southern Oregon in Ashland. There's actually very little crossover in terms of, because students find more than one place, we've done an analysis of what that overlap is. OSU has a clientele which is statewide, and there's some competition for students with U of O and Portland State. Portland State, because of its unique location and mission, has a clientele which, it's not captive, but it has a unique clientele of its own, and it bends over backward to provide services to facilitate part-time students and students who are outside their traditional. So that's part of it. But there's a certain enforcement role, and the board insists that there be as much collaboration as possible. Jim Lucier, our board member from Bend, refers to this, what's the Charles Atlas phrase, dynamic tension. The competition that's present in the competition for the branch. I think that's quite healthy, and I think that what Bend will get out of this, Central Oregon will get out of this, is a better proposal. But it has to be managed, and it has to be kept in a healthy vein.
A quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I might. Following up on the business analogy on your resource allocation model, the campuses get to keep student-generated or locally-generated fees like tuition and dormitory fees and lab fees and all of that, as well as a per-student support from the state general fund. Together, those two do not add up to what it costs to educate that student. Am I fair in making that assumption?
Not in all programs. But we have to balance that. And so for every student in English, where your costs are at one level, balanced against the student in engineering, where your costs are three times that, we have to make that work. And we do it through funds from our foundations. Mm-hmm. We do it through special grants to particular programs in a department or whatever. We do it through the use of some of the overhead generated by grants and contracts, but the overhead numbers are shrinking as agencies give you less and less to deal with there. Mm-hmm. We have to make it balanced. We don't run that at a deficit.
Okay.
But it's I'll give you an example where we've had to make some adjustments. OIT in Klamath Falls. Mm-hmm. We gave them in their mission mostly expensive programs. We've had to balance that by granting them in the last 5 or 6 years several new program opportunities where the yield was high and the costs were more moderate. For example, we allowed them to move into a program in applied psychology, and that's given them some significant enrollment serving public service agencies, health service agencies, and that's less expensive than engineering technology. So we have to balance it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Joe, talking about the new funding model, would it be in jeopardy if the current proposed budget shortfall in the general fund were to be enacted? Would that jeopardize the new funding model?
Well, what it does, Chair Backlund, at some point probably yes, but I think what it has the effect of doing is lowering how much we achieve toward that average of our peers. It drops us in terms of where we were given where we were trying to get, but I'm not prepared to give up the model because I don't want to go back to the old model. But what it does cost us is it has the effect, if we don't raise tuition to offset it, it has the effect of serving a greater number of students with fewer dollars. And when you do that, you've diluted the cell values per discipline. And so that's what we're wrestling with at the moment.
Is our funding model unique, would you say, or?
Well, we get a lot of calls to appear here and there to talk about it nationally. No, it's not. I can't say to you that it's unique. It is, in my experience, in the public sector, and that's Arizona, Maryland, Pennsylvania, a few other assorted places. It's pretty unique. We were challenged from the start by those who felt we were making a commodity out of education, that we were bringing too much of a business model to it. But I think the values of the universities are still squarely focused around the liberal arts and sciences core of what they do and the belief in undergraduate education. I'm not worried about that piece of it. But in answer to your question, it dilutes, it would have the effect of diluting where we are.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Cox, I appreciate your presentation this morning. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the effect of the proposed budget, the governor's budget, on your continuing efforts to adequately fund faculty salaries. I know that from the University of Oregon, President Frommeyer has been complaining about faculty salary levels for a number of years, and he's told us at least that he's concerned about being able to hire quality faculty. What effect is this change going to have on that kind of endeavor around the state?
Representative Barnhart, it obviously makes it much more difficult. We were able this last time to cobble together funds from other sources. We reallocated resources within the institution beyond funds that were granted for salary increases. We went beyond that. Western Oregon was probably the best example. Salaries there were the lowest in the system. They stepped up and reallocated through leaving positions vacant and made a significant dent in where they were, not where they'd like to be. But in the budget, at this point, we're very dependent upon the general state employee salary increase that's in the budget. That's not in our budget, it's in the general budget, and that's, at this point, that's close to being the only dollars we have for salaries at this point.
Okay. And a follow-up, if I may. Chancellor Cox, do you have an idea of when you're likely to know in a with a better estimate than you were able to give us today.
The end of February.
Okay. What I'm asking about really is what the likely tuition increases would be in order to compensate.
Well,
because I think what you've just told me or told us is that 4 plus 4 based on this CSL probably is not adequate. I think that's what I heard.
Representative Barnett, members of the committee, the 4 plus 4 offsets $25 billion in cuts that weren't made. And I think, I personally, and I'm not speaking for the board yet because they've not made a decision, nor even for the president, I do not feel that, I can tell you in certainty that that's going to be enough. We may have to come back and ask for a 0.5%, 1%, or something beyond that.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So
I think we'll have a better handle on that. I thought you were asking about the magnitude of some of the kinds of adjustments we're going to have to make, and that's the end of February. But I'm talking their program and activity rather than tuition. Tuition probably won't get resolved until March, April, if then. It winds up typically being the balancer, as once we've seen the estimates in May and you all know what the real dollars are, then we sit down together and look at what's the short, and that's about when tuition is honestly set. We can talk abstractly prior to that, but my guess is it'll follow traditions in the past and come down to a April-May decision. Grattan, is that, do you disagree? Okay. Other questions?
Chancellor Cox, we appreciate your testimony.
I'll come back at any time. I obviously believe in what we're doing and believe it's important. So given a chance to mount my soapbox, I will. Also, I would like to offer the invitation that if there's information you would like, just give Grattan, Karen's, across the street, a call, or myself, and we'll try to get it for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, at this point, I'm going to open a public hearing and a possible work session on three bills, I think, and we're going to change the order a little bit. We're going to first hear on House Bill 2125, secondly, House Bill 2124. And then we'll follow with House Bill 2198. We had intended to hear House Bill 2176, but we think we're going to postpone that until perhaps next week.
Okay,
so with that in mind, we'll open that public hearing, and I think we have some invited testimony from the Treasurer's Office. Pardon me? Yeah, just one moment, Sam. And before we do anything else, I want to have the opportunity to welcome Treasurer Randall Edwards, who I had the pleasure of sitting in two committees with last time, and we became quite close, I feel, and so I'm delighted to see you, Randall, and Treasurer Randall, and we're happy that you can be here to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that introduction, and for the record, my name is Randall Edwards. I'm the State Treasurer of Oregon, and it's a pleasure to be here to talk to you a little bit about a couple of bills we need to have the body pass to help us implement a new powerful tool to help Oregonians save for college. Maybe just to give you a little context of before we get into the bills themselves about this plan, and in fact, Mr. Chair, you were involved in a committee that passed this bill out to the floor. What we have done in this state, and we began last session by passing Senate Bill 750, which allows Oregon to set up, in this case, a college savings plan so that individuals, grandparents, parents can put money aside with tax benefits to saving for higher education. And you just heard testimony about the challenges of tuition and in-state institutions. Private schools have seen tuitions rise, and the fact is we've got a challenge here in this state and across the country in helping individuals afford college at all levels. And what this program does and what we were able to do last session was to tie into a national trend where Congress a few years ago allowed states to set up vehicles for individuals to save, and this is one of them. We're one of the last states to have hooked into this federal tax code change. Congress saw this as a national problem. States have been running to create these new saving vehicles, and we last session hooked into this tax change. What we have found, and you may have read in the paper, we just put the first account was opened less than 2 weeks ago. The demand is there. We've already seen over 500 accounts, almost $1.5 million have been put in already. And I don't anticipate that demand will change. As this program gets more and more known, I think you're going to see millions of dollars put into this. And that's been the trend, not only, looking at other states that have set these up for the first time. So what we've done is come to you today with a couple of bills, because as we've gone through taking the law, putting it in a form and making it workable for us and to make it as easily accessible for Oregonians, we found some changes that needed to be made. And this is, I think the foundation of the program isn't changing at all in this with these changes, but what we're doing is fine-tuning this so that the program will be on more solid footing. It has more accessibility, and in the end, this is going to, I think, long-term be a big plus for all of us here, not only in the building, but for the state. What I'd just briefly on 2125, the way this plan works is individuals can put in money, parents can put in money by opening an account on behalf of a beneficiary. And the intent of this law nationally and for us as well is to have those monies used for higher educational purposes. As I described, it can be tuition for two-year college, technical school, four-year college, graduate school, in-state, out-of-state, private or public. So it's very flexible. What we don't want to have happen, and what this bill addresses, is that we have given one of the ways that this plan works is that when you put your first $2,000 into this plan, you can actually write that off as a joint filer against your state taxable income. What we don't want to have happen, and what this bill closes a potential loophole, is somebody opening an account, taking the deduction off, taking it off their state taxable income, and then closing the account and then moving on. Again, the purpose of this whole plan, nationally and locally for us, was to make sure people putting money away for college. That $2,000 deduction was put into the bill last session, and the whole intent of that was to give an incentive for people to begin to put money aside. As you know, the challenge is to get people to put money to save for college, for retirement, and in this case, we in the legislature felt that was appropriate. In the fundamental plan, once the money's in, it grows tax-deferred, both state and federal. And then when it's being used for these educational purposes, then it's taxed. The growth is taxed at the beneficiary's rate. That's the fundamental plan. So this bill, House Bill 2125, simply says that you can't open an account, take the state tax benefit of $2,000 in this case, and deduct that off your taxable income and then close it and move on. So that's really simply what the first bill does. Do you want me to move on to the next one, or do you want to
I think we'll just focus on one at a time,
okay.
If that's okay.
Great.
Comments, questions from members?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, Treasurer Edwards. These accounts allow the taxpayers to accrue tax-deferred earnings on that income as well.
That's correct.
And yet, in your addition on page 3, line starting at line 32, it appears to me that you don't penalize the taxpayer for any appreciation or interest accrued on that account. You set a limit of the amount that had previously been deducted.
the way that there are penalties, for example, let me step back.
Okay.
The federal law said you can't use these for non-educational purposes, and if you do, you're penalized, I believe, 10%. But it's on the earnings because you've already paid taxes on the money going into it. So that's where the penalty on the national level, and we would follow that because that's the law. What we're concerned about is that we put an additional incentive into this program beyond the deferral of the $2,000 off your state taxable income deduction that you can take if you're a joint filer and put in at least $2,000. And so what we're trying to do is shorten that to close a potential problem whereby somebody could put the money in and then pull it out. And it's on the principal, not the earnings.
Just to make sure I understand it, Mr. Chair, because it's a little complex. I'm supportive of what you're trying to do. I just want to make sure that you are closing all the loopholes.
Right.
And if you are confident that you're closing the loopholes for both the initial principal contributions and that there's already an overriding federal closure on any, and penalty actually, on the earnings, and that our tax code follows that precedent on the earnings, then I'm fine.
It does, and you just explained it very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I might add that I was a part of this bill, and I was excited about it then, and I'm certainly excited about it now. And I'm personally of the opinion that that it's good that we can anticipate a potential problem and close that loophole up with this technical fix. So,
yeah.
For whatever it's worth, from my perspective, this is a good thing.
It is.
No one else has signed up that we know of. Would anyone else like to testify on this? Okay, with that in mind, then, we are going to close the public hearing and open the work session. Do I have a motion?
Yes.
Excuse me. This bill does have a subsequent referral to the School Funding and Tax Fairness / Revenue Committee. Excuse me. And so any motion would have to reflect that as well. So we have a motion.
I'd make one, Mr. Chair, if I knew exactly what the form was. The intent of my motion would be that we recommend that the other committee and the House pass this bill. But I'm not sure what the correct form is, never having heard such a motion before.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I can move that we send this bill to the School Funding and Tax Fairness / Revenue Committee for their review.
With a due pass recommendation.
A due pass recommendation.
Very good. Any discussion? Okay, I think we're ready to vote. Clerk, you call the roll, please. Excuse.
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Are you sure?
Aye.
Barnhart also votes aye.
If you don't know how to make a motion, you don't get to vote.
Don't get to vote. I think I figured that out.
Very good. Well, the motion carries. And at this point, we would like to open a hearing on House Bill 2124. And Treasurer Edwards, if you would like to continue.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and here to talk to you about House Bill 2124, which has a few more changes to this plan. And with me is Michael Parker, who is the executive director who's responsible for administering this plan on behalf of the state. And perhaps what I could do is have him kind of walk through each section. But in essence, what this is doing is number about two or three things. One is we're wanting to make sure it's clear whose account when that's opened, who can have access to it and who is the beneficiary. We're setting up a relationship between the state and the account holder as a trust, so that the only interest that the state has is to make sure that we're a fiduciary and that these monies are well managed and invested. Just on that point, the state hired Strong Investment to manage the accounts and offer up the different types of investment opportunities for Oregonians. And you may ask, why does the state have a role in this at all? Again, going back to the federal law said there has to be some entity in the state to administer to make sure that the monies are being used for college purposes. There's a state entity. This is a national plan, to give you some flavor. There are other plans out there offered by other states that Oregonians today could take advantage of. But what the advantage we have with this plan, of course, is one, it's administered by the state of Oregon. We've got we're very confident in who we selected in Strong to manage these accounts and to make solid investments on behalf of Oregonians. But also, we have this tax benefit that you can take advantage of here in the state. So the point is this really isn't just an Oregon plan, and there's a point in here that you'll hear from Michael about how we're going to offer individuals outside of Oregon to put money in, which will strengthen this plan, because the more assets you have in a program like this, it drives the cost down. It will also ensure that we are competitive and that our person we've hired, Strong, is competing nationally and keeps them in check as well, so that their product, I have no fear that they will not be strongly, investing this money, but that it keeps a check on them. And again, if you look around the country, these plans are available to individuals throughout the country, and that's another change we want to make to this plan. It will strengthen it for Oregonians, it will help drive the cost down, and it will have this check and balance on the firm that we hired. So what maybe Michael could do is just kind of walk you briefly through the sections and then answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, and Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Plan. What I'd like to do today is just walk through the eight changes, the modifications to our plan that are listed in the testimony here. These changes were crafted basically to enhance the plan and enhance protections to our beneficiaries here in Oregon. The first one, we want to change in the original law the meaning of account owner from an individual to a person, and basically that means that would allow a corporation or a trust to set up an account. So if a child has a trust, that trust can be the account owner. Currently, only an individual can be an account owner. We've had a lot of questions from folks that children have trusts, and they want to be able to have the trust be the account owner and administer these contracts. So we're changing the meaning from individual to person to allow corporations or trust to be an account owner. And moving on, we're also clarifying language in our bill that would allow the designated beneficiary and the account owner to be the same person, which would allow an adult to put money in to go for job retraining or to get an additional degree. Currently, our current law isn't as specific to what if you can or cannot do that. Other plans around the country allow for that. So we want to make sure that our plan is as flexible as possible. Moving on to Section 2. This change just designates that contributions and earning in the plan are held in trust for the sole benefit of the beneficiaries. So our plan is a trust. Moving to Section 4, this change would designate that the Oregon Qualified Tuition Savings Board, which is chaired by the state treasurer, it's a 5-member board, is the trustee of the contributions and the earnings. So it clarifies the oversight of state government. And as the treasurer mentioned, Section 5 is one of our big changes in this bill. It allows residents from other states to contribute to Oregon's plan. And basically what that does is, built into the contract with Strong, when we sign the contract, there are breaker points in our contract that as assets grow to certain levels, fees are automatically reduced. So the more assets we have coming into the plan, the more benefits our beneficiaries here in Oregon are going to get, which is what we are really worried about. So if we can bring in out-of-state money, our fees are reduced. The fees that Strong charges are reduced. So that's the reason for the out-of-state residency requirement. C- currently, the current law says that either the beneficiary or the account owner must be an Oregon resident, and that's the language that we're excluding on this change. Section 6 basically says, goes back to the trust, ensures the money that's in this plan is protected from garnishment or from bankruptcy or from insolvency laws. So the money is held in trust for education for the kids. So we want to make sure that it's not attached to anything else. Another change that is actually really important for us is it allows distributions from an account to be paid directly to the beneficiary in order to pay for off-campus housing. Currently, our law states that checks are written from the plan to the university jointly, to the university solely, or jointly to the beneficiary of the university. That would not allow for students to pay for off-campus housing. So we want to make sure that Strong can cut checks so folks can use it for off-campus housing purposes as well. And then lastly, we're making sure that the information that people sign up on the account, their personal information, is protected from disclosure. And the only way that information could be disclosed is if they wanted to have it disclosed, they have to sign in writing. The information can be held out. So we're trying to protect that account information from being disclosed. So those are the basic changes. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That last change, if I understand you correctly, basically takes it out of the purview of the public access rules. Is that correct?
Representative Barnhart, that's correct. What we wanted to make sure was that the list of our participants wasn't given to other financial firms.
Ah.
So we want to protect folks from that kind of thing. That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Michael, number 3 designates that contributions in joining the plan are held in trust for the sole benefit of the participants and the beneficiary. Was it before not for the sole benefit?
The language wasn't clear before. We're just clarifying it to make sure that is clear in the law.
So this is a language.
Yes, it's a clarification.
Change that quite possibly it could have gone to somebody besides.
That's correct, and the representative, the these plans are so new around the country. They've only been out 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. And so we're still kind of working out how they should be set up. We wanted to clarify in our bill for sure that these were held in trust, and I think the initial law wasn't clear.
Thank you.
It is a clarification.
Janet, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Parker, this is nothing being changed by the bill, and it's a minor question, but in Section 5, line 42 of the bill, the contributions to an account shall be made only in cash. I was just curious about that requirement.
The plan won't accept property or other assets, stocks. It only accepts cash. Mm. And that is a federal requirement. Mm. The IRS does not allow for any other contributions except for cash. It won't accept anything else, property, stocks, anything else. So that is a federal rule. And as you may know, that our law follows federal law to the T. So.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Treasurer Edwards, and is it Parker?
Yes.
Mr. Parker, I'm so proud of what, you know, has transpired here, and I feel it's wonderful for our kids, and, you know, I really appreciate the progress that's been made. Can you tell me how this is this plan is administered as far as liability, you know, relative to investment and what happens when you're ready to go to college and you've just had a stock market crash or heaven forbid? I'm just curious of, you know, of our funding protection.
Well, the way this is set up, and this is a savings plan, and I believe we passed out a packet which shows you the different types of investments you can make. There are 4 options you can make. Again, federal law said you can only, every time you have an account, you've got to designate where you're going to, what type of investment you're going to make, what type of investment. So one option, for example, is a very aggressive stock option. You can have a second option, which is more moderate investing. Third is a conservative approach. And the fourth is a blend whereby, for example, when I opened my account on the second, I put my money in that one, which is the investment portfolio attracts my child's age. The younger the child, the more aggressively invested and equities, and then as my child gets closer to college or college age, then it's a more conservative approach. Just like in retirement, you want to make sure your portfolio isn't all in stocks, and then all of a sudden you're trying to draw an income off of it, and you've got these volatilities. So that last one is really designed to take the burden off of, in some ways, the investor, you, to make sure that you're tracking what you need to do in the marketplace so you don't have that problem. Are there guarantees with this? No. I mean, I have to be frank about that. This is just like any other time you put money and invest it. But what we're looking at is a track record with strong good returns. All three four portfolios, when you look at where they're putting their money, have done very well and will do well for the investor. And there are no guarantees. I mean, that's the way this plan works. It's a savings account. You get tax benefit. There's nothing else like it out there. I mean, before these were created, this was brand new. This is brand new. So the whole idea here is you can literally put thousands of dollars away under this. I think the cap we've put is $150,000 per beneficiary. Pretty big chunk of money if you can do it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Our continuation, how about that? Treasurer Edwards, my concern is the liability. Who assumes the liability of the management of this fund?
As I understand your question, if, for example, Strong does not perform as we set out in the contract, that rests with the board. And we have a very tight contract about what we expect of them. And one of the things the Treasury does all the time, and in fact, that's partly why this whole program was lodged in the Treasury, was we are money managers, and we contract out a lot of our monies to outside money managers. And we are constantly reviewing their performance relative to others in the marketplace. So we will make sure that they meet the targets that they've set out. And if they don't, we can fire them. That's the ultimate leverage.
Yes, Representative.
Chair, if I could continue. Is there a reassurance? Is there any type of an insurance program that can be developed with this fund? In the event that, I happen to be a victim of a program with a bank where when my three children were ready for school, unfortunately, the value of this stock was very diminished. I would hate to see that happen for someone who thinks they're helping their grandchildren go to school and ultimately they're not. So I'm concerned. I mean, is there a FDIC, is there any type of program that it's a wonderful program, and I think the greatest crisis would be a child ready to go to school and their funds had been greatly diminished. What we forget as an administrator of a 401k and the developer of pension type programs for a number of employees for years, we forget that the individual made those decisions, and there's ultimately some type of custodial liability that goes with this, with a board or an oversight agency. So this is my concern, to see if there is a vehicle that would allow us some type of insurance policy that would protect these funds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, currently there is no insurance policy. As the Treasurer mentioned, we have a board that oversees the program, and as far as our investment manager is concerned, Strong, they are monitored also by the NASD and the SEC. So there are checks and balances on Strong. As far as the plan goes, there is no insurance policy that would guarantee a child any return. It's a market-based program. So currently there's no insurance policy built in that would guarantee you any type of return. It's similar to any investment you would make for retirement, where you are hoping you're making the right decisions with your investments and they are going to increase, which is part of the reason we selected Strong, because they have an outstanding track record. But again, we all know that the fluctuations in the market, and that's where the plan is at right now.
Michael, I presume that any contributor could check on his or her balance for the beneficiary at any time?
Correct.
Hopefully, Representative Nelson, there would not be a surprise that at the time the young person was about to go to college.
Mr. Chair? On that same point, Mr. Chair, don't participants have the option of selecting a money market or equivalent kind of fund with strong? They don't have to invest in an aggressive stock fund.
Correct.
So if a grandparent were concerned about the security of the funds, they could select a money market or similar kind of fund that might not have the upside potential but has almost no downside potential.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Mm-hmm. Is there a program, Treasurer Edwards, or Mr. Parker, anywhere, the Lloyd's of London or any other group that allows us an opportunity to buy down risk? And I would recommend it, and I'm just wondering if there is such a program that's done in other industries, and I come from an aviation industry where it's certainly essential that you do so. But I just wonder, in this type of funding, you know, in your world, is there such? If not, perhaps it's something we could work on.
Mr. Chair, yes. So I understand the liability you're concerned about. You're not really concerned about returns, really. You're asking, like, if Strong went bankrupt, I mean, in essence, what's the safeguard? I don't know if I have an answer to that right now. And I think that's what you're saying. Is there an insurance policy that would guarantee? That's a good question, and I think I'll get back to you on that. But, you know, as is anything, if you went to Lloyd's of London, I mean, there's a cost. I mean, this is no net fee type of situation. So I'm not sure. That's a good question to ask. If as far as guaranteeing returns, no, we can't and we don't. As far as bankruptcy or something like that, if that's what you're talking about, that's a different take, and I never heard that question asked before. And we'll get back to you on that.
And I'm not sure. What we'll check is that the trust issues in our plan may have covered us for that such an event, since these plans are held in trust. So we will definitely find out and get back to you on that question.
Just to point out, because we're changing this relationship of the board as a trustee, that brings with it all sorts of federal law as a fiduciary that, for example, I have to the PERS account. It's the same type of relationship, and I've got to prudently manage this in a way, as does the board, to meet my fiduciary responsibilities. And that change alone should help bring some comfort that we're going to do the right thing for the benefit of the beneficiary. But the issue of bankruptcy or something like that, I have to look into that.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds to me as though we're talking about two different kinds of risk. One is the investment risk, and the other is what I would refer to as the custodial risk, although you may have another name for it. I think you've covered the investment risk issue quite well, and I think I understand that. But I think the part you've just been talking about is custodial risk issues, and I'd be very interested in understanding the detail of that, too. It really isn't germane to the bill, I think, but perhaps it is. If the company referred to simply is instructing the trustee about the changes in investment, and the trustee is actually some organ of the state of Oregon, then of course you don't have that problem. But if the funds are actually held by your investment advisor, then that's a different problem. And I think it would be useful to get an answer to that kind of question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonnerhart, what you're raising is, if you went out, you personally went out and bought a mutual fund right now, I mean, what's your recourse against that mutual fund if that's not the market rate's return didn't meet what you expected, but something financially happened to that organization, or they were taken over, something happened in that case, if you wanted to take a recourse, what would it be? I can get back to you about that. But again, the fundamentals of this plan were set up by Congress to give states an opportunity to set up a partnership generally with a private entity, which has been most of the case. I don't think there's I don't know if any state's done it alone without going out and hiring somebody. If you're using a financial market, there are all sorts of recourse and law that follow investing and who's held accountable for what. And I'd be happy to get back to you on that. But as far as what we're asking today is just to make some modifications to the bill so that we have a stronger possible plan as we can for Oregon. And as Michael was saying, we went through a year process, year and a half, to put this together, and we found some changes we need to make.
Well, thank you for committee for your questions, and thank you for your testimony. We will close the public hearing and open a work session. I would entertain a motion to move House Bill 2124 to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Chair, Representative Donner.
I would like to make that motion and to simplify things, use Representative Smith's words, word for word, except make it 2124 instead of 2125.
Thank you. So Representative Donner moves House Bill 2124 to the School Funding and Tax Fairness Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
I just have a question because I'm not familiar with procedure. Since this bill is being moved on to another committee, will Representative Nelson's questions be answered, or will that be an attachment that goes with it?
Janet, might you help us on that one?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith. The Revenue Committee, the Tax Fairness, excuse me, the School Fairness Committee,
Revenue.
Will have a hearing on the bill, and the Treasurer's Office can present the information that you requested to the Revenue Committee, but I'm assuming they'll also be able to get this committee a letter between now and when this goes to the Revenue Committee and make the explanations that you've asked for. And if you have any further concerns about it, we could transmit those to the Revenue Committee staff.
And then will Representative Nelson receive the information that she needs also?
Certainly. Mm-hmm. We'll get it to her.
I think Representative Barnhart also requested information.
Yeah, I think he
yes.
Yeah, Representative Marchette.
That will be given to all of us.
Yes.
Okay. So that make it easy. Move that on to all of us. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? With that in mind, clerk will call the roll, please.
Morissette?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Yes?
Aye.
Excuse.
Donner?
Aye.
Rebecca?
Aye.
Barnhart?
Aye.
Hobson?
Hobson's excused. That then, the motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2198. And please come up. Very nice to see you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Good morning. For record, my name is Dan Bernstein. I'm the president of Portland State University. And this is a rare opportunity for me. I think it's the first time I've appeared before a legislative committee without asking for any money.
All right.
I'm a foreman for either of us later in the session. I'm here in support of House Bill 2198. A bill which does not appropriate any funding to PSU, but rather recognizes several programs that are very that are nationally recognized at PSU and also unique to our urban mission. The Mark Hatfield School of Government, which has been named after one of Oregon's most popular and respected public servants. The Center for Lakes and Reservoirs, the Graduate School of Social Work, and also the Institute for Portland Metropolitan Studies. PSU and the State Board of Higher Education request this legislation because it really provides us an opportunity to have statutory recognition, which we hope will allow us to generate private support and also federal support for these programs. So we're seeking statutory recognition not because we're seeking an appropriation, but rather we see this recognition as an opportunity for the university to go to our private donors. We're now in the private phase of our capital campaign. We'll soon be embarking upon the public phase of that campaign. And these programs will also will be integral to that campaign. And as we look for federal legislative support, we believe that state statutory recognition will be will enhance our ability to attract federal funds.
Thank you.
So with that, I'll ask for any questions.
Questions? Mr. President, other schools have done this similar sort of thing?
Yes. In fact, I think last session, the University of Oregon's brain biology machine program was received statutory recognition. The University, Oregon State has statutory recognition for some of its programs. Three of the four regional institutions are recognized as comprehensive universities, so there is a precedent for recognition of either programs or universities in general.
Mr. Bernstein, you can't see any downside to doing what this bill suggests?
Chair Becklin, no, I don't see any downside at all. It's as I said before, there's no appropriation attached to this. I think it recognizes programs at PSU that are already nationally recognized. For example, we have the only graduate school of social work in the state of Oregon. That's very consistent with our urban mission. These other programs also have that that same kind of recognition. So I don't see any backside, any downside at all.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Good morning, Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr, excuse me. Yes, Representative Effer.
Mr. Bernstein, President.
Yes.
Bernstein, right?
Yes.
I appreciate what you have done, and I think that's, you know, y'all are to be commended for this stepping out in some areas that, you know, where no one, like urban studies or the social work programs, where you've really filled a need that's been missing in our education system. This says there's no cost involved with this change whatsoever.
Yes, Chair Becklin, Representative Nelson, there's no cost at all associated with this statutory recognition. What this will do, this will allow PSU, as we go to donors in our private capital campaign, as we seek federal legislative support, monetary support for these programs, the fact that the state has given statutory recognition to these programs, we believe will enhance our ability to attract both private funds as well as federal funds.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bernstein, is it required that each program of every college be specifically stated as a statutory position?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, not at all. And we are not seeking recognition for all of our programs. What we've tried to do is identify those programs at Portland State that, one, have achieved a level of national recognition, and, two, programs that we believe have the greatest potential for both private as, and probably more importantly, federal legislative support. And so we have not sought recognition, and none of the other institutions in the system have recognition for all of their programs. We've really tried to identify programs that we are that we see are critical to our mission as Oregon's urban university. Mr. Chair, may I make one other statement? This bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and I would respectfully request that referral be rescinded because this bill really has no negative budgetary impact.
Yes, thank you. We had anticipated doing that, and but it's nice that you remind me, so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, thank you very much, Mr. President, and we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
With that, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session. Do we have?
Mr. Chair.
Do we have a motion? Yes.
Yeah. Do we need a motion to rescind the?
Yes.
The referral and then a motion to.
We're going to combine them, Representative.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move that we. Send this bill before the due pass recommendation and rescind the referral of Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Starr has moved that we move House Bill 2198 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the further recommendation that the referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion? Clerk, by your call, would you call a roll, please?
Nelson?
Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
McFaul?
Aye.
Bummer?
Aye.
Sherbacklin?
Aye.
Barnwood?
Aye.
Excused?
Yes.
Aye. The motion carries unanimously. Committee members, we have a new House rule this session that will allow unanimous vote out of committee to move to the consent calendar.
All right.
Do I have a motion to move House Bill 2198 to the consent calendar?
So moved.
The chair.
Thank you. Representative Morissette has moved that House Bill 2198 be moved to the floor and moved to the consent calendar. Any objections? Hearing none. Bill's passed. The motion's passed.
All right.
With that, then I think we can adjourn this morning's meeting. And thank you, members, and thank you, audience.
Yeah.
Well,
so the consensus is no period.